Hey guys, this is Beth Golay. And before we get started with Marginalia, I just wanted to say that KMUW's podcast platform is made possible by High Touch Technologies, a software technology and business communications company that provides products, services, and support to all industries. High Touch brings the human touch to technology with a world-class team of industry experts. Learn more at hightouchtechnologies.com. And now, here's Marginalia.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia, notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
When most readers hear the name Tracy Chevalier, they correctly remember her as the author of Girl with a Pearl Earring, which was her second of 11 published novels. Her latest is titled A Single Thread, which explores a group of women who, after World War I, were charged with embroidering cushions and kneelers for Winchester Cathedral. All of her novels are rich in historic detail, to which Chevalier credits her years as a reference book editor for teaching her about research and accuracy in the writing process. I recently caught up with Tracy Chevalier in London, via phone, of course. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. You know, many listeners will recognize your book, Girl with a Pearl Earring, but the one we're talking about today is actually your 11th book, and it's called A Single Thread, and we actually have a clip of the audio version of A Single Thread. And I was wondering if we could just listen to a bit of the beginning, and then maybe you can explain to the listeners what's happening.
Sure.
Shh. Violet Speedwell frowned. She did not need shushing. She had not said anything. The shusher, an officious woman sporting a helmet of grey hair, had planted herself squarely in the archway that led into the choir, Violet's favourite part of Winchester Cathedral. The choir was right in the centre of the building, the nave extending one way, the presbytery and retro choir the other, the north and south transepts short arms fanning out on either side to complete the cross of the whole structure. The other parts of the cathedral had their drawbacks. The nave was enormous, the aisles draughty, the transepts dark, the chapels too reverential, the retro choir lonely. But the choir had a lower ceiling and carved wood stalls that made the space feel on a more human scale. It was luxurious, but not too grand.
So Violet Speedwell is in Winchester Cathedral. What's going on there?
Violet is just come in to have a little look around, and she lives in Winchester, which is just about an hour south of London, and the cathedral is very beautiful, and she goes there looking for solace, looking for quiet, looking for contemplation, and she finds herself joining a service that she's not quite sure what it is.
And then later, you know, just a few pages later, we find out that it's actually the presentation of the embroideries. And this group of women who were in this cathedral, they were called broderers. What exactly is that?
Well, there was a group of volunteer women who made various things for the cathedral. And in the 1930s, they had a project, a huge project to make cushions and kneelers for the choir stalls of the cathedral. And they made something like 98 cushions and 360 kneelers. So there was a lot of work. That's why it took 7 years. And it was all organized by a woman named Louisa Pessel, who designed the patterns that they used, and she also organized all the women, taught them their stitches, made sure they got them right. Because as she said it, these cushions and kneelers are going to be used every day for hundreds of years, and they need to look good. So this is a service where all of the work they've done so far is blessed by the dean, and then it's put into use. And I based this on, there really were presentations of embroidery services throughout the 7 years they made them. And so I decided that's how I would have the book start, with Violet Speedwell, my heroine, finding her way to one of them.
And I'm just kind of curious, so the kneelers that were embroidered in the 1930s, are they still around? I mean, what kind of material are they made from? Because there was a part in the book, and my Latin's going to be bad, but is
Ars longa vita brevis. Art is long, life is short. Yeah, so this stuff, if you go to Winchester Cathedral, you can sit on those cushions and you can kneel on those kneelers or sit on them. They're still in use and they're still in really good shape. Now, there's still a volunteer group of broderers, and they, which is a medieval term for people who do embroidery. And they have recently done repair work on some of the cushions and cleaned them. So they're looking really bright. And they're made of wool, embroidered with wool, and it's quite coarse wool, so it's, although there's some very fine wool as well for some of the finer details. But they've just been really, really tightly sewn and well made so that they will last for as long as they're needed.
Now, I want to go back to the time where you set this in the 1930s, and Violet, you know, she had no experience but was drawn to the broderers because she wanted to make her mark on the world. And, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about Violet in the 1930s and the notion of a surplus woman.
Yeah, when I started doing research, because I knew I was going to be setting the book at that time, I wanted to find out more about what women's lives were like then. And that, this is when I came across this label that the newspapers of the time came up with called the surplus woman. And they found out in a census of 1921 after World War I that there were almost 2 million more women than men. And the newspapers went a little crazy with this and said, oh, the surplus woman, she's going to be a huge problem for society. Because at the time, it was a society that was based on the idea that women would get married and have families. And that's what their expectations were. There were very few career choices open to them. And if they did have a job, they were expected to quit when they got married. And they didn't know what to do with these women. And so if they didn't marry, they became very dependent on their families for economically and socially. So my heroine, Violet, is one of these women. She loses her fiancé in World War I, and she never meets anybody she can marry after that. And so she's been living with her parents, and at the age of 38, her mother's driving her crazy, and she decides to strike out on her own. And I think I wanted her to find a way to have an independent life and be happy. And that's really what the story is about. And the cathedral and embroidery becomes one element of her creating her own community and support system.
You know, this might be kind of an odd question, but the setting of A Single Thread is Winchester Cathedral. And I understand that Jane Austen is buried there. Do you have an affinity for Jane Austen, or did you choose it as a setting because of the interesting stories in spite of Jane Austen?
Ha! I love Jane Austen, and I definitely knew she was buried there, but that wasn't why I chose Winchester Cathedral. Well, I looked around Winchester at one point thinking, what cathedral do I want to set a book in? And I looked around and I thought, you know, Jane Austen, it's a very interesting story of her death. Is she lived with her mother and sister in a house probably about 15 miles from Winchester. And when she had her last illness, she and her sister came to Winchester to see a doctor to see if he could help. And he couldn't, and she died, and her family decided to pay that little bit extra and actually have her buried in the cathedral. But on the original gravestone, which is this slab on one of the aisles of the cathedral, it doesn't mention at all that she's a writer, which I just found astonishing. But there is a memorial to her put up much later, about 80 years later, that does celebrate her being an author. And you always see flowers there and people making a kind of pilgrimage to her grave. So I could have written about that, but instead I was drawn to the cushions and kneelers. But I do love her. I mean, who wouldn't? So I'm thrilled that I've set a book in the same place where she died.
It's clear that your books are heavily researched, and I understand that you attribute your work as a reference book editor as teaching you a lot about research. I was curious about how much of your research actually makes it into the book, and how much do you have to just let go?
I like a lot of it. I probably research 10 times the amount I use. But it's very hard to quantify because a lot of the research is actually just a way of creating, of understanding the time and place I'm setting a book. I didn't live in the 1930s in Winchester, so I have to feel my way into what it was like to be there so that ideally, when I've done enough research, I can imagine what it's like to walk down the streets of Winchester, what people would be wearing, what the cars would smell like and sound like, how many of them would be on the streets, what sort of shops I'd see, what would the shop fronts look like, how do you go in and buy something? You know, these days we do our own scanning of checkout or, you know, how much is behind the counters? What would a room, a single woman's room in a boarding house be like? What would the furniture be like and the carpet and the light in the room? All of that stuff. What would she eat? All of that kind of detail takes a long time to absorb. And so I've written a lot of notes down and read a lot, but I don't necessarily show that specifically. But I have to do the research so that I feel comfortable writing about a period without necessarily showing off everything I know. I need you, the reader, to feel confident in my knowledge that I know what I'm talking about. So that's why I do so much research that never makes it into the book. And I've read other historical writers where you can just see they found this wonderful little nugget, and damn it, they're going to find a way to weave it in. And it just shows. And that's one of the pitfalls of historical writing that you have to be really careful about.
Earlier, we listened to a snippet of the audiobook, and I was wondering, do you have any say in how that comes together? Do you get to approve the narrator? And this one was read by Fenella Woodgard. Do you have any say in that?
What happens is there's a department in the publisher who does audiobooks, and the woman who runs that, she chooses a kind of short list of potential actors or actresses who might read it, and she knows all of their voices really well. That's her job, too. And so she'll choose a few and send me snippets of what they've read in the past or give me links to things that they've read so I can listen. I listen to them, and then we discuss what we think, who we think would make, you know, do it best. And yeah, it's always a little tricky because inevitably I have my own idea of what somebody sounds like, and you're never going to find, they never sound like somebody who already exists. You know, they sound like themselves, but they're unique in my head. But there are definitely actors or actresses, I listen to them, and I go, no, 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 that's absolutely not. But it's rare I go, yes, yes, yes. And actually, with Fenella Woodgard, I heard her and I thought, oh, yeah, I think this is going to work. And I had the wonderful experience. They asked me if I wanted to go and listen to her read some of it. Not the whole of it. It'd take hours and hours. But I went to watch her read for an hour, and it was just so wonderful. She was so good. And she did all the accents of the different people, the women, the men, the, you know, little kids and old people. And she does it all just beautifully. And it's amazing to hear something that has been in my head the whole time suddenly made flesh, so to speak. And it was just wonderful. She's got a really gorgeous voice, and I think it matches it really well.
You know, I was looking at your website, which is tchevalier.com. And I love that you've listed what you're reading. You know, the most recent one is The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead. But I was looking back through some of your August selections, which a lot of them tend to mirror what I've read just recently. How do you choose what's next as far as what you're going to read?
I read a lot of reviews. I get sent a lot of books by publishers thinking that I might quote on them, and I don't quote very often, but occasionally I do. But best of all, I guess, get recommendations from friends. I have friends who read a lot, and we're always passing books back and forth and saying, oh, have you read that? Oh, wasn't that great? Or that was really terrible, or I was expecting that to be really wonderful, and it wasn't. And so it's from a variety of sources, but mainly from personal recommendation. I think it's really important not to always read the new, shiny new thing that's come out.
Right.
of background, you know, things from the past that need reading. So this summer I read A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr, which is a classic set just after World War One, and it's really beautiful. And then I was in France on vacation, and I decided I'd read Julian Barnes's Flaubert's Parrot, because it's, you know, he wrote it in the 80s, and it's just sometimes you need to mix it up a little bit. And I have so many books I haven't read that are sitting around the house, but I'll go into a bookshop and I'll end up buying something because it looks so good. And then I just go home and that goes to the top of the pile. And I read that instead of all the other things that I probably should read. So it's a constant battle. And there's also that wonderful and also pressurized moment when, which I'm at now because I just finished something and I'm thinking, what should I read next? Mm-hmm. What am I in the mood for? And I look at all the piles of books I have and I sort of panic, like, what should I don't know what to read. And then I end up, you know, going to the bookshop and getting something altogether different. So it's a wonderful problem to have, though.
Is there anything that you want to talk about a single thread or anything else that I haven't asked that you want listeners to know?
I suppose one thing is that I do tend to do the thing that my characters do in the book. So I learned how to do needlepoint for this book so that I could write about it.
Did you have to pick out a lot of stitches?
I did. It's so true. I did. But it just is so much easier to write about something when you've done it already, and then you know what the feel of the wool in your hands is, or how you have to hold the canvas, or how you thread the needle, and all of those things. I mean, I could imagine them up, but it's so much easier just to have done it and then describe it.
That was Tracy Chevalier, author of the book, A Single Thread, which was published by Viking. The audiobook excerpt was provided courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio from A Single Thread by Tracy Chevalier, read by Fenella Wolgar. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.